Okay, so you guys sent us a case, and it's a case that really throws a wrench into the gears of arts funding and free speech. National Endowment for the Arts v. Finley.
Yeah.
It gets right to this question.
Right.
Can the government use decency standards to pick and choose who gets arts funding without tripping over the First Amendment?
Right.
You know?
Well, what's fascinating about this case is that it
Yeah.
forces us to think about the government's role, not just as a regulator, but as a patron of the arts.
Right.
We're talking about taxpayer money being used to support artistic expression.
Right. And this whole thing explodes during the culture wars of the 1990s,
Right.
a time of heated debates about what's considered acceptable art. Congress, trying to respond to a public outcry over art deemed offensive by some, passes an amendment.
Right.
This amendment requires the NEA,
Mm.
the National Endowment for the Arts,
Right.
to consider general standards of decency and respect for the diverse beliefs and values of the American public when awarding grants.
It seems almost impossible to pin down, you know? Th
Yeah.
that language raises the question, how on earth do you define decency, especially when it comes to something as subjective as art?
Exactly.
What might be offensive to one person
Yeah.
could be completely harmless to another.
And that's precisely why this case landed in the Supreme Court's lap.
Exactly.
Four performance artists, known for their avant-garde and often provocative work,
Right.
are denied NEA grants after this amendment passes.
Yeah.
They decide to fight back.
Yeah.
And not just for themselves, they go for what's called a facial challenge.
Right.
Have you heard of that?
A facial challenge means they're arguing that the amendment itself is unconstitutional,
Right.
no matter how it's applied.
Yeah.
They're saying the very idea of the government using decency as a yardstick for funding is inherently flawed.
So their argument isn't just, hey, we deserve that grant.
Right.
It's more like this whole system
Right.
is rigged against certain types of expression.
Exactly. Now, their journey through the courts is a roller coaster.
Oh.
The District Court and the Ninth Circuit actually side with the artists,
Wow.
saying this decency provision is too vague and opens the door for discrimination based on viewpoints.
Sounds like a win for free speech.
Well, hold on, because the Supreme Court,
Oh.
in a tight 8-1
Oh,
decision,
wow.
flips the script and reverses those rulings.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
What was the Supreme Court's reasoning for this reversal?
So they get into some pretty intricate legal arguments.
Yeah.
They essentially say there's a difference between the government directly regulating speech, which
Okay.
it generally can't do,
Right.
and the government choosing how to spend its money,
Okay.
where it has more wiggle room. They argue that this amendment didn't ban certain types of art outright, but simply added decency as one factor the NEA should consider.
So it's not censorship because they're not saying you can't create this art.
Right.
They're just saying don't expect us to foot the bill.
Right.
But doesn't that still feel like a way to control what kind of art gets made?
That's the heart of the dissenting opinion in this case. Justice Souter,
Yeah.
the lone dissenter,
Right.
argues that decency, being so subjective, is
Yeah.
ripe for abuse. He worries that using it as a basis for funding could easily turn into viewpoint discrimination. He sees the potential for this to become a tool to favor art that aligns with the majority's sensibilities.
So on one hand, we have the argument that the government has the right to decide how it spends taxpayer money.
Right.
On the other, there's the concern that this could be used to silence certain voices and perspectives.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the majority opinion tries to address this concern
There.
by saying that all arts funding inherently involves judgments about content. Every time a grant is awarded, it implies that one project is deemed more worthy of support than another.
Right.
The key question, they argue, is whether the government is systematically excluding certain viewpoints.
Right.
And in this specific case, they say there's not enough evidence to prove that.
But wouldn't the very presence of a decency standard make artists second guess themselves? I mean, if you know your work might be deemed too edgy or controversial,
Yeah.
wouldn't you hesitate to even apply for a grant?
That's what's known as the chilling effect, and it's a major concern for free speech advocates. They argue that even the potential for censorship can be enough to stifle creativity and limit the range of artistic expression, and that chilling effect is one of the biggest criticisms of the Finley decision. It's hard to measure definitively, but anecdotally, there's been this sense that artists, especially those relying on government funding, might shy away from pushing boundaries as much.
So it's like a subtle pressure to self-censor.
Right.
You start thinking, maybe I should tone it down a bit if I want a shot at that grant. But doesn't that undermine the whole point of supporting the arts in the first place?
Right.
Shouldn't we be encouraging bold, challenging work?
You're hitting on a key tension here. If art is meant to provoke, to question, to make us see the world differently, then how can it do that if artists are always looking over their shoulder, worried about falling afoul of some vague decency standard?
And this wasn't just a theoretical concern, right? Did the Finley decision lead to more of these decency clauses popping up in arts funding?
It did. It did give a kind of legitimacy to that approach. Several states implemented similar provisions, often using even broader, more ambiguous language than the federal law.
So even though the Supreme Court didn't create a hard and fast rule,
right,
it opened the door for more of these subjective standards to creep into arts funding.
Exactly.
And how have those state-level provisions fared in court?
There's been a mixed bag of outcomes. Some courts have upheld them, citing Finley as precedent, while others have expressed skepticism, especially when there's a whiff of viewpoint discrimination.
It sounds like we're still walking a tightrope here. On one side, there's the government's interest in using taxpayer money responsibly. On the other side, there's this fundamental right to freedom of expression, even if that expression is controversial or makes some people uncomfortable.
It's a classic balancing act, and that's precisely why Finley continues to spark debate. It didn't provide a clear-cut test, but it did lay down some markers. For example, for a facial challenge to succeed, remember that's like trying to knock down the entire law.
Right.
It must be shown that the law always leads to censorship. The mere possibility of abuse isn't enough.
Okay, so the bar is set pretty high for striking down a law on its face. But the court also stressed the need for viewpoint neutrality.
Right, and this is where things get really tricky. The government can't use decency or any other content-based criteria as a smokescreen to shut out certain perspectives it doesn't like.
Right.
It has to be genuinely about content, not a hidden agenda against specific viewpoints.
So you're saying the government can't just say, we don't fund art that criticizes the government?
Right, but they could potentially say, we don't fund art that depicts graphic violence.
Right.
Is that the distinction?
You've got it. And even then, courts would look closely to see if that rule is truly content neutral or just a way to target certain viewpoints.
Yeah.
For example, are they applying the graphic violence standard consistently across different types of art, or is it selectively enforced?
So it's not just about the words themselves, but how they're actually applied.
Exactly. And another layer of complexity comes in when you consider different types of funding programs. In a competitive program like the NEA grants in Finley, where artists can theoretically seek funding elsewhere, the courts tend to give the government more leeway.
So it's like saying, look, you're not being silenced, you just didn't get this particular grant. You can still try to find other sources of support.
That's the logic, but critics would argue that it's not always so simple. Government funding often carries prestige and legitimacy that private funding might lack. It can be a huge boost to an artist's career. Right. It's not just about the money itself. It's about what that funding represents. But what about situations where artists have fewer options, where government funding is the main game in town?
In those non-competitive programs, courts are much more suspicious of any content restrictions.
Okay.
They recognize that if the government becomes the sole gatekeeper, there's a real danger of chilling free expression.
So it's like a sliding scale,
yeah,
where the level of scrutiny depends on how much power the government has in that particular funding landscape.
And that's where Finley's legacy gets interesting. It didn't create a formula, but it sparked a whole wave of litigation that has forced courts to grapple with these very nuances.
Do you have any examples of cases where Finley came into play in other areas, maybe beyond the art world?
Absolutely. Finley has been cited in a surprisingly diverse range of cases, from internet filtering in libraries to the placement of religious monuments in public parks.
Wow, those seem like pretty different contexts.
Yeah.
Tell me more about how Finley has been applied in those cases.
Well, one prominent example is United States v. American Library Association, which dealt with the Children's Internet Protection Act. Libraries were required to install internet filters to block access to certain content if they wanted to receive federal funding.
I remember that one. There was a lot of debate about whether those filters were actually preventing kids from accessing harmful material or just blocking legitimate websites.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court, upholding the law, looked back at Finley to support the idea that the government can impose these kinds of conditions on funding, even if they involve content restrictions.
So they were drawing a parallel between the decency standard in Finley and the internet filtering in libraries.
That's right. They basically said that in both cases, the government was acting as a patron, deciding how to spend its money, not as a censor directly controlling what people can say or access.
But wouldn't those filters inevitably block some viewpoints, even if they weren't explicitly targeting them?
Right.
For example, what if a website that provides information about safe sex practices gets blocked because it mentions certain keywords?
That was a major concern for critics of the law. They argued that it amounted to viewpoint discrimination, even if it wasn't intentional. And even Justice Stevens, who generally sided with the majority, expressed some reservations about the potential for chilling effects.
So even when citing Finley as precedent, the court recognized that there are limits to how far this idea of government as patron can be stretched. What about the case involving religious monuments? That seems even further afield from arts funding.
That one is Pleasant Grove City v. Summum, and it gets to the heart of what's considered government speech.
Government speech, what does that mean exactly?
It refers to situations where the government itself is conveying a message rather than just regulating what others can say. In the Summum case, a religious group wanted to donate a monument to be displayed in a public park that already contained other monuments, including the Ten Commandments.
Ah, so it touches on those thorny issues of separation of church and state and whether the government can appear to endorse one religion over another.
Exactly. And the city refused to display the Summum monument, arguing that it didn't align with the city's history or values. The Supreme Court sided with the city, leaning heavily on the Finley principle that the government has more leeway when it comes to its own speech.
So they're basically saying that choosing which monuments to display in a public park is a form of government speech.
Yes, and they went even further, arguing that this type of government speech doesn't have to be viewpoint neutral. In other words, the city could choose to display monuments that reflected its own preferred messages, even if that meant excluding others.
That seems like a pretty slippery slope. Couldn't that open the door for the government to pick and choose which viewpoints get a platform in public spaces based on its own preferences?
That's precisely the concern raised by critics of the Summum decision. They argue that it gives the government too much power to shape the public discourse and that it could be used to marginalize minority viewpoints or suppress dissenting voices.
So it's like Finley provided a framework, but then subsequent cases like Summum pushed the boundaries of that framework, leading to even more debate about the line between legitimate government speech and potential censorship.
That's a great way to put it. And these debates aren't just academic exercises. They have real-world consequences for how we experience and participate in the public sphere.
That's a good point. This isn't just about legal theory. It's about how we define the very spaces where we encounter different ideas and perspectives. So we've seen how Finley has cast a long shadow, not just on arts funding, but on the broader landscape of free speech. But I'm curious about something else. Has this whole decency debate actually changed the art itself? Are artists playing it safer, steering clear of certain themes or styles to avoid controversy and keep those funding streams flowing?
It's a tough question to answer definitively.
Yeah.
Art is always evolving, influenced by countless factors.
Right.
But it's hard to imagine that the Finley case and the cultural climate it reflects hasn't had some impact on artistic choices.
I'm thinking about that chilling effect we talked about. Even if there isn't outright censorship,
right,
the mere possibility of losing funding could be enough to make some artists second guess themselves. Do you think there's a risk that we're losing out on some truly bold, groundbreaking work because of this?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate concern. Art thrives on pushing boundaries, challenging norms, sometimes even making people uncomfortable. And if artists feel pressured to self-censor, to stay within certain perceived limits of decency, then the art world and society as a whole becomes less vibrant, less intellectually stimulating.
It's like we're trading artistic freedom for a kind of bland, inoffensive middle ground.
Right.
But doesn't that defeat the whole purpose of art? Isn't it supposed to provoke us, to make us think differently, to start conversations we might not otherwise have?
Precisely. And that's why it's so important to have a robust and diverse ecosystem for supporting the arts. If artists have more options, if they're not solely reliant on government funding,
right,
then they have more freedom to take risks, to explore difficult themes, to truly push the envelope without fear of reprisal.
So diversifying funding sources, a mix of public and private support.
Right.
Could be one way to mitigate this potential chilling effect.
Absolutely. A plurality of funding sources can create a more independent, more resilient art world.
Okay.
One that's less vulnerable to political pressure or shifts in public opinion.
But that brings us back to the role of government. should they be involved in arts funding at all?
Right.
Given the potential for controversy and accusations of censorship?
That's a debate that's been raging for decades. Some argue that government funding, by its very nature, will always be entangled with political considerations, and that it inevitably leads to a certain level of control or influence over artistic expression.
But others would say that public funding is crucial for supporting art forms that might not be commercially viable,
right,
for nurturing emerging artists,
yeah,
and making art accessible to wider audiences.
Exactly. And there's also the argument that government support for the arts reflects a society's commitment to fostering creativity, critical thinking, and cultural enrichment. It's a statement about the value we place on these things.
So it's a complex issue with no easy answers.
Right.
But if the government is going to be involved in arts funding, what are some ways to minimize the risks of censorship and ensure that artistic freedom is protected?
Transparency is key. Clear guidelines for funding decisions, open and accountable grant-making processes,
yeah,
mechanisms for addressing complaints or concerns about bias. These are all essential.
It's also about promoting diversity.
Yes.
Not just in terms of who receives funding, but also in the perspectives and voices that are represented in the art itself.
Mm.
We need to make sure that the arts landscape reflects the full spectrum of human experience,
mm,
even the parts that make some people uncomfortable.
You're absolutely right. And that diversity of voices is essential not just for the art world itself, but for society as a whole. Art has the power to challenge us, to broaden our understanding, to connect us with experiences and perspectives that are different from our own.
So in a way, the Finley case is a reminder that this constant negotiation between artistic freedom and societal values is never truly settled.
Right.
It's an ongoing conversation.
I agree. And it's a conversation that we all have a stake in. Whether we're artists, policymakers, or simply engaged citizens, we need to be thinking critically about these issues, advocating for policies that support artistic expression, and challenging any attempts to stifle creativity or silence dissenting voices.
Well said. This deep dive into NEAV Finley has been a real eye-opener. It's a reminder that art matters, that freedom of expression is a cornerstone of a democratic society, and that these are values worth fighting for.
Couldn't have put it better myself. And as technology continues to evolve and new art forms emerge, these questions about the boundaries of free expression and the role of government in the arts will only become more complex and more crucial.
This deep dive has definitely given us all a lot to think about. Thanks for joining us on this journey.